Welcome to Women on the Line, one of Community Radio's National Feminist Current Affairs programs produced by women and gender-diverse broadcasters at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne on unceded Kulin lands and broadcasted nationally on the Community Radio Network. I'm your host, Senya. On today's show, we listen to a panel discussion about the new research released by the Racial Profiling Data Monitoring Project. We hear from Dr. Tamar Hopkins, a researcher on racial profiling, Sabrina Adem, a community organizer, Lauren Caulfield, advocacy coordinator at Beyond Survival Flat Out, B. Charika from the Rising Red Lantern and Vixen, and Dr. Tasnim Samak, Palestinian activist and organizer. The panel was moderated by Idul Ali, a community organizer. The following discussion talks about racism, family violence, policing, and raids on migrant sex workers. If any of the content distresses you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can call 13 YARN, and queer listeners can call QLife on 1800 184 527. Let's now have a listen to the panel.
Before we begin, I want to briefly situate tonight's conversation with the newly released 2025 racial profiling data from Victoria. The findings show clear and consistent evidence that Victoria Police continue to racially profile communities across the state. Across 2018, 19, 22, 23, and 24, police were less likely to find anything when searching people they perceived as African, Middle Eastern, Indian, Asian, or Pacific Islander compared to people they perceived to be white. That means these communities are being searched on weaker grounds, a clear sign of racial profiling. In 2024 alone, Aboriginal people were 15 times more likely to be searched than white people, and African people about 9 times more likely. Pacific Islander and Middle Eastern communities were also largely targeted at several times the rate of white people. The disparities escalate even further in police use of force. Police were 10 times more likely to use force against Aboriginal people and over 7 times more likely to use force against African people. Taser use was 13 times higher against Aboriginal people and more than 6 times higher against African people. Pursuit rates were extreme, almost 24 times higher for people perceived to be African. These patterns were occurring despite similar or lower fine rates compared to white people. The data also shows major gaps. Around 17% of search records and 12% of use of force records are missing ethnic appearance data, even though reporting has been mandatory since 2019. So that's to say that it's up to the police whether or not they write that information, and there's times that they're choosing not to, which we all know why. Overall, the findings confirm that systematic racial profiling continues in Victoria, contradicting the 2025 ban, and that the impacts from criminalization to trauma, injury, and family disruption are severe and far-reaching. Tonight's panel explores what this means for our communities and how we resist it. I'm going to throw the first question over to Tamar, the person who put together this data, and I wanted to ask you, and we're going to be moving around some mics, so bear with us. When analyzing your most recent police data from Victoria, what trends concerned you the most?
Yeah, so it was really interesting this year to have the use of force data for the first time next to the search data. What was fascinating about that was to see how it was exactly the same communities that were facing over-searching that were facing excessive police use of force. And so that really shows how it is that initial police decision who to select for a search that is then translating into a whole host of other activities, and we can see that excessive use of force and is likely to be contributing to excessive imprisonment rates. So what this data is starting to pull together is the patterns of policing and how they work, how one act escalates to the next. So that's really, really clear, clearly apparent in this data. And another really clearly apparent thing in this data was the way it's uniform branches who are engaged in the excessive searching and are also engaged in excessive use of force. And I think we often think about force looking at police protests, looking at the the crime groups that police have, and look at policing in those kind of exceptional circumstances. And we fail to see, when we hear those reports, that actually excessive searching and use of force is an everyday experience by uniform branches across the state. And it's particularly that the data is clearly apparent in rural areas as well as in metropolitan areas. So we can, the charts showing where this policing is happening shows just how widespread this is and how racialized these patterns are. So I think that they're some of the really clear patterns that are coming out. But yeah, there's so many interesting things to be looking at the way use of force against Aboriginal women is even greater than the general pattern of use of force. We're seeing 10.6 times the rate of use of force against Aboriginal women than white women. This is just absolutely astonishing that we're actually getting this data from the police themselves. This is what this is revealing, even though we know that the police are not recording all of their use of forces, and we don't know the rate of recording of search instances, but we can imagine that there'll be gaps in that too for the most egregious types of cases. So it's quite extraordinary what this is showing us.
Thank you, Tamar. Sabrina, can I ask you, how do you see the analysis of police data like this being useful for our communities?
I think it's tricky because, like, when I first read the data, I wasn't surprised. I saw it and I was like, oh yeah, like, evidence to back what all these young people have been saying, all these communities have been experiencing, and I think it's so important to do that work, but I don't think there's the most, like, direct impact to communities right away. I think the impact needs to be, like, towards media. Like, I think that's where the impact is. I think they read that and it's news to them and it's, like, this revolutionary piece. I think it's great to be able to hold police accountable, and I think that's so important. But in terms of, like, directly impacting community, the community know, like, they've been experiencing, they've been seeing this data play out in their daily lives.
On community radio around Australia, you are listening to Women on the Line. Today we are listening to a panel discussion about the latest research released by the Racial Profiling Data Monitoring Project. The panel was moderated by community organiser Idil Ali. We just heard from Dr. Tamar Hopkins, a researcher on racial profiling, Sabrina Adem, a community organiser, and up next we'll hear from Lauren Caulfield, advocacy coordinator at Beyond Survival Flat Out, B. Charika from Rising Red Lantern and Vixen, and Dr. Tasnim Samak, Palestinian activist and organiser. The following discussion talks about racism, family violence, policing and raids on migrant sex workers. If any of the following content distresses you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can call 13YARN. And queer listeners can call QLife on 1800 184 527.
Speaking to the power that the court system and the state has to extend things, I really want to put a question to you, Laws, about around the family violence space. In Victoria, police are central to family violence responses, yet many victims, survivors, hesitate to seek help because police intervention can escalate the harm that they're experiencing. I want to ask you, what are you seeing in your work about how racial profiling shapes family violence responses?
That's a great question. I want to also acknowledge that we're meeting on unceded Wurundjeri country and pay my respects to elders past and present. I work in a project that works at the intersection of the violence of policing and family violence. When we saw the data come out of the Centre Against Racial Profiling, we were It's absolutely in line with what we're seeing in practice. You know, in terms of what Sabrina spoke about, we echo the same thing. The data follows lived experience. You know, in terms of family violence, we think it's really, it's a crucial area for that data battle because it's one of the places where police have been most successfully located as a site of safety or a solution to family violence, and where we see some of the most reluctance to kind of consider alternatives, often on the basis of this assumption that police are the only ones who are capable of responding to family violence and addressing risk, when in reality what we know is that very often survivors of family violence are being deeply harmed by family violence policing. We know that police perpetrated family violence is itself an enormous issue. In terms of the racial profiling element and the racialised policing element of family violence policing, it's really stark. You know, so what we're talking about is really a continuum of, you know, that ranges from lethal indifference through to sort of punitive targeting. And I think that that nexus of the racialised and gendered policing that occurs in family violence is really crucial to understand because of this manifestation of the types of violence that occurs. So one of the examples would be, you know, we absolutely, you know, when we're talking about punitive targeting, it's the type of data that came through around, you know, more than 10 times are more likely to use force against Aboriginal women. But we're also considering things like, say, the practice of what often gets called misidentification, right? This idea, so where police are incorrectly identifying the person experiencing violence as what, you know, they use the language of predominant aggressor. And we know that it is overwhelmingly happening to Aboriginal survivors of family violence, it's overwhelmingly happening to refugee and migrant communities, but it is so often located as a mistake. You know, and that's something that is often really echoed in the family violence service system, this idea that if we just speak with police, they will remedy that mistake. And so this data, much like data that's been gathered, you know, we surveyed 270 family violence workers, 85% of them talked about seeing police wrongfully identify victim survivors, 90% of them talked about seeing biased and discriminatory policing, including racial profiling. And then we look at evidence coming from specialist services, so JIRA, formerly the Aboriginal Family Violence Prevention and Legal Service, said 90% of the Aboriginal women that they support have been incorrectly identified by police as the predominant aggressor or the person using violence. So it's racial profiling by another name, and that is made absolutely plain in terms of examining who is being wrongfully identified by police. So what it actually is a measure, you know, of racial profiling in action, which is just one of the ways that I think, you know, racialised policing really shows up in this particularly gendered way when it comes to family violence.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking to that, it really makes me think about the work that B does in regards to the police being able to frame something as protection when it's actually harm, and framing things as mistakes that are actually racial profiling. So I want to ask you, B, what is the Australian Border Force... Why is the Australian Border Force heavily targeting Asian migrant sex workers in Victoria, and what narratives or assumptions drive that racial enforcement?
Yep, so hi, my name is B. My pronouns, they, them. I work at Vixen, also run the Rising Red Lantern project as well. I don't know if you have heard about us. So Vixen is a peer sex worker organization, and I'm also an Asian migrant sex worker. I think that's a really good question. So today, I know you're talking a lot about the police and the data that just came out, but in our community, I think sex work and the cops is a long history that's harassment, that they not even give a fuck what we're doing, or when we report, they not even care, I think. And a lot of time they're using our work to against what we report. And when I'm talking about Asian migrant sex worker, I need to address about what happened on the streets based sex work as well, because of often in Victoria, even though we have decriminalization for sex worker, we still left out migrant sex worker and a street based sex worker, and that is put our community at risk of the law enforcement. For example, street-based sex worker is still, you know, can't work in a certain time, certain place, like only can work nighttime, can't work close to schools, childcare, and if they do that, that is still criminalized. And when they said near, like can't work near some places, near is still not really clear what it near means, which means that it's really clear that it depends on the cops, what they can use it against street-based sex work. So I just want to address that before I'm talking more with the Australian Federal Police and Australian Border Force, that a lot of, which is now, we've seen increasing the rate that happened within our Asian community. We've seen increasing of, especially this year, it's already at least 18 places has been raided since January, and already 11 workers at least has been cancelled visa on spot. When I said 18, think about one place, it might be 5 to 10 workers, that means hundreds of workers have been harmed by Australian Border Force, which is, I will go furthermore with the next question, but as you can see on the photo here, when you ask, like, you know, the form of the policings, no, that is the next question, but as you can see, this is some example. This is from the Federal Police website, that how they use to indicate when they're going to raid at the brothels or massage parlor. Like, some of that information is mistakes. For example, worker that they think worker moved from one places to another places, it means that person risk of trafficking. But apparently, it's pretty common to all of us, or someone stay over at the brothels, that mean that person is trafficking, because they're using trafficking to raid.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you, Tasneem, we're seeing strong links being made between policing here in Victoria and global systems of racialized surveillance and militarization. As someone organizing in Palestinian spaces, how do you understand the relationship between local racial profiling and broader global machinery of white supremacy? Just a little question for you.
No, I get these questions. Thanks everyone for being here and for moderating this panel and for having us come together. I like how you're scoping out the topic, you know, and bringing people from different areas. I think, like, yeah, as a Palestinian organizer, but also I'm in education, so my research was on, like, 9/11 generation and the de-radicalization framework and counter-terrorism. So I think from that perspective, I think, yeah, people often don't think that that's part of police work, but it actually is. Like, since 9/11, the national security framework, national security framework has actually redefined crime and, racism and crime. And we're really seeing that with the Free Palestine movement and the way that even, like, I would say an observation from that is that even, like, white youth, just because they're involved in, like, a movement that is a racialized movement, because it's Free Palestine, they actually get racialized, you know, by association. So that's been really interesting, because, when 9/11 frameworks were being developed, it was about the Muslim radical. But now we're seeing the expansion of that, where even climate youth are being called extremists. Like, even, yeah, whoever's at, I would say that the rallies today, they're not majority Arab or Muslim, actually. It's like a whole combination of people. But yet they're treated as the other, like as the violent terrorist other, because they're part of that movement. And that's a little bit different than when, like, you know, September 11 happened, and the people who were being rounded up were, like, people who looked Muslim, you know, they looked brown, and they were being profiled based on more, like, appearance-based racial profiling. So I would say that's something interesting. But in terms of, like, global systems, I think it's always good to go back to the basics, you know, like, why does the state have a police force? And that helps us understand the racial, you know, manifestations of that. It's, you know, like crime itself is a manufactured thing. It's a construct. Like the state creates crime, and the state creates class as well. So poor people, they like the state makes them poor. The state creates refugees. The state creates, you know, like the Palestine issue, right? Like there's an issue that was is an issue is because we're occupied people, and so once that kind of violence is enacted, and then people, of course, are oppressed. And once they're oppressed, they want to reclaim justice. They want to reclaim their rights, and they want to push against the oppression that they're facing. And then what do you need? You need enforcers. And I think that's the history of policing, actually. Like, in this colony, it is they needed police to keep Indigenous people on reservations and deprived of rights much after the frontier wars. We know in the United States, it's, you know, the slave patrols. It's because the enslaved population was trying to, you know, get out of those conditions. They fought hard, they rebelled. And policing got harsher and harsher to tame people, to tame populations. And even like if you go before the establishment of this colony, I mean, this is a convict colony, so that is policing. Like, that is part of the history of policing here, is that there were poor people in the, you know, in Great Britain who were causing lots of trouble for the Queen and for the Crown. And so they were repressed. And part of the way they were repressed is establishing this convict colony. And so I think we can't talk about policing without talking about resistance. They come together. Racism is one way that distracts us from being able to see that being what police do. But in the Palestine movement, you see it very clearly, because there, when people show up, they don't see themselves as a criminalized group, right? They see themselves as demonstrators, but actually they are being criminalized. So you see it very overtly when you're in a protest that the police are there to be enforcers. But in some of these other dynamics that you're speaking about, the relation is more invisible in terms of like how police are repressing that population.
It's almost as if, not almost as if, but there's an expectation. When I think about young people, and Sabrina, I'll pose a question to you in a moment because you work in that space, and Yusuf, I reckon you'd be able to answer it too because I know that you mentor a lot of young people, but something that stands out to me is young people, before they're politicized, that they are dealing with policing, they're being policed in their communities, and what you talked about, Tamar, about a lot of the data is not from the protests, it's on the day-to-days. It's people in their communities, with their families, with their friends, you know, just going about their days. And this is for all the panelists, I guess. The laws, the state is going to change the rule book. What are we doing? What are we doing to be, I guess, flexible? What are we doing to resist and I guess like not playing to their rule book? What are we doing to create our own rule book or continue to enact ours? I feel like I'm not asking it well, but do you guys?
Is that me?
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I think it's very difficult because the state holds the power here. And when we are like fragmented, this is sort of what happens, and it's coming from all directions. So we're seeing the change in the bail laws, you see that adult time, adult crime thing, you know, you're seeing designated area, you're seeing the anti-protest laws, the demolition of public housing, you know, and the cost of living, like this is all at once. And then you see the repression of protest movements at the same time. So I think that is on purpose. It's not like, you know, yeah, that's by design to make us, scramble to know what to defend and who to stand up for. Ironically, it's all happening while signing off treaty. So it's like, how is this such a progressive government enacting such harsh laws that will be permanently harassing and targeting and oppressing racialized First Nations and other racialized communities. But I think that's the only way that the state is going to deal with the problems it's created. So that's why I was saying, like, a systemic analysis is really important. With, like, the kind of crisis we're in, manufactured by the system itself, will mean that it will, that's the direction. To deal with the very upset population and more social unrest, it's going to build more prisons. The job sector we're already seeing is shifting. There's not enough jobs that are more on, like, the welfare side. And the jobs are like security, prison guards, like, you know, those are the industries. If you're poor, go work as a cop. Like, if you're poor, go work as security. Yeah, and the last point on that is that this is, like, it's a wave. Like, we had a little wave of, like, an appreciation of, like, the youth sector, like, these other things. But all of that's being culled, and we're seeing it in education. And what's being, you know, resourced is more of that harsher carceral system. And that's not accidental. And I think that's very difficult for our movements to deal with. Because we feel like, you know, we've progressed so much, and then the state comes and, you know, like, culls all these things. But that means we need to be sharper, like, stronger, and come together in a more confrontational way against the state.
And that's all for Women on the Land today. Today we heard snippets of a panel discussion regarding the latest research by the Racial Profiling Data Monitoring Project. We heard from Dr. Tamar Hopkins, a researcher on racial profiling, Sabrina Adem, a community organizer, Lauren Caulfield, advocacy coordinator at Beyond Survival Flat Out, B. Charika from Rising Red Lantern and Vixen, and Dr. Tasnim Samak, Palestinian activist and organizer. If the content was distressing and you need to chat to someone, you can call Lifeline on 131114. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can call 13YARN, and queer listeners can call QLife on 1800 184 527. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support. The theme music for Women on the Line is by Ripley Kavara. I'm Senya, and tune in to Women on the Line next week on your local community radio station.